basically unzipped the whole ice cover along the coast from Cape Lisburn all the way to the Canadian High Arctic.
A surprisingly early melt for Arctic sea ice. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a bill that would put the state in charge of school district health insurance.
SB 90 provides a vehicle, creating a large pool of employees from all school districts, with the state administering the program on behalf of school districts.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
This spring, the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean is breaking up early, and scientists are scrambling to figure out why. It's not unusual to see open water leads appear near Barrow, even in the middle of the winter. But there is something different about the open water this year. It's adding fuel to a theory that the Arctic Ocean will be ice-free in the summer months in a few years, instead of a few decades. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
It started with an unusual storm that passed over the North Pole on February 8th. The National Snow and Ice Data Center noticed that it caused the sea ice to crack and the cracks to spread in a curving pattern from the tip of Alaska to Canada. Similar patterns have appeared in the past, though not of this scale. What usually happens is the leads freeze back up. But Assistant Professor Andy Mahoney of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute just got back from several days of helicopter overflights out of Barrow.
This year, it's been pretty persistent, and I think that's really what marks this year as being different from the other examples that we've seen.
Geologist Richard Glenn of the Barrow Arctic Science Consortium has been watching the sea ice phenomenon closely.
It basically unzipped the whole ice cover along the coast from Cape Lisburn all the way to the Canadian High Arctic, and we saw it here. It was impossible to miss, of course.
There's been a trend of sea ice freezing up later and breaking up earlier for decades, but the ice has also been getting thinner. And in recent years, the remaining thicker ice formed over a period of several years has been breaking up and flushing out. Mahoney says this winter, their intensive helicopter search found none at all.
We went looking for multi-year ice. We were hoping to find maybe some small isolated flows that the satellites hadn't picked up. And we didn't see any sign of multi-year ice. So we do believe that the Beaufort Sea at the moment is pretty much devoid of multi-year ice.
There is plenty of theory, but the reality is that nobody knows how this thinner, so-called new ice is going to behave. The giant leads that appeared in February may have been triggered by a storm, but their persistence could have more to do with the ocean's internal heat dynamics. Warm water flows into the Arctic from the south, but it mostly stays deep, with colder meltwater on top of it. In recent years, with less ice, the ocean is darker, and that upper layer has been absorbing more heat from the sun. Scientists have not been able to pin down which heat source might be involved in weakening the winter ice. One thing Mahoney knows for sure is that warm water has shown up right next to shore at Barrow.
We have a measurement site in the landfast ice at Barrow, and what we observed just a few weeks ago was actually melting of the ice, even in winter. And we saw 5 centimeters of melt in pretty much just a single day. And that appears to be related to a warm pulse of water passing underneath the ice.
That open water is right in front of town, says Richard Glenn.
And we don't even need the space images to see it. It's right in front of our front window.
Subsistence whalers are concerned about the open water lead. They can usually count on a sturdy layer of ice along the shore in the springtime that allows them to travel out to set up their camps near the bowhead's migration path. But longtime North Slope Burrow whale biologist Craig George says this year is different.
You know, the ice broke right to the beach, which typically doesn't happen. It didn't happen in the past as much when there was heavy multi-year ice mixed into the landfast ice.
The heat budget of the Arctic Ocean is at the root of a major dispute between climate scientists. Computer modelers expect an ice-free Arctic by 2030 or 2040, but a growing number of field scientists say there must be some things the modelers do not understand about local conditions, and they expect ice-free conditions within just a few years. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
A measure that would put the state in charge of school districts' health plans is speeding through the legislature. Right now, school districts negotiate their own health insurance plans. The legislation would allow a state commissioner to select a plan for all the districts, and it would essentially put all educators into one large insurance pool. The idea is that the bigger the pool, the lower the rates. A number of school districts have offered their initial support for the bill. Today, Mat-Su school district officials testified that such a change could save them more than $5 million. Bruce Johnson with the Alaska Council of School Administrators also called in to say he supports the move.
If there's a means to create efficiencies, we stand behind the effort. SBA 90 provides a vehicle creating a large pool of employees from all school districts, with the state administering the program on behalf of school districts.
But there are some concerns that the bill has been moving too quickly and that the legislature has not studied the full cost to school districts or the state. Companion bills were introduced in the House and Senate 2 weeks ago, and while they had been assigned to the education committees in both chambers for review, those referrals were ultimately removed. The pacing of the bill came up when Senator Mike Dunleavy, a Wasilla Republican who sponsored the bill, asked Rhonda Kidder of the National Education Association for her group's take on it.
Is your group against the bill? Is your group against what you perceive as the speed at which the bill is progressing? Could you clarify that for me?
Our group is against the bill with the speed at which it is progressing. We do not feel that there has been sufficient notification to the employees or sufficient research into the impact.
The legislation is now in its final committee of review in both chambers. The U.S. Senate voted this morning to begin debate on a new package of gun regulations. Neither of Alaska's senators supported it. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, today's vote was procedural. It does not create any new laws, but it does kick off what will be weeks of emotional debate.
Before it even gets to the new laws, the Senate needs to agree to talk about them. The Byzantine rules of the Senate are contained in the 1,600-page book Riddick's Senate Procedure, Precedents and Practices. One rule in particular has dictated the Senate for the past few years, cloture. Cloture allows debate to begin in the Senate, and it requires 60 votes. Here's freshman Senator Brian Schatz presiding over the cloture vote this morning.
On this vote, the yeas are 68, the nays are 31. Three-fifths of the senators duly chosen and sworn having voted in the affirmative, the motion is agreed to.
And with that less than plain English, the Senate begins debating the first new gun measures in nearly two decades. The core bill calls for universal background checks on gun sales, stiffening penalties for straw purchases, that's when someone buys a gun legally for someone who cannot, and increasing school safety.
It's a base bill that we were filibustering in the sense of the cloture vote was problematic for what I have heard from Alaskans on a pretty regular basis.
Senator Mark Begich joined 28 Republicans and one fellow Democrat in filibustering to force a cloture vote. That means they were trying to prevent the Senate from even debating and amending the core package. There will be many attempted amendments, and the bill will look different weeks from now than it does today. Two amendments are guaranteed to get votes, one regulating the size of magazines and an assault weapons ban. Senator Begich says he's talking with Majority Leader Harry Reid about allowing a vote on one of his amendments. That amendment would force states to enter people who are legally barred from owning a gun into the National Instant Criminal Background Check System.
When you have 600,000 people across this country, about 2,000 in Alaska, Alaska being one of the 22 states that don't put any of this information into the NICS system when someone has been deemed mentally incompetent and should not possess a firearm.
Senator Begich says he's had minimal contact with the State Department of Law and the state court system about entering those 2,000 names. He says he talked to state legislators about the issue when they visited D.C. earlier this year. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who has repeatedly called for regular order, that process of debate and amendments, voted against it. In a crowded subway underneath the Capitol, she said she's worried that bringing the bill to the floor would strengthen the chance of an assault weapons ban, something she calls a non-starter.
Do we move forward on a bill that I think is pretty fatally flawed?
That bill is moving forward. One of the first amendments will be one that expands background checks to gun shows and online sales, while excluding private sales. Senator Murkowski says Alaskans would not tolerate background checks for person-to-person sales, but would not say whether she supports them at gun shows and online. While the Senate has cleared a major 60-vote hurdle, more votes are in store. Each amendment will need 50 votes to pass, and once every amendment is finalized and the final package crafted, there's another 60-vote threshold to end debate. Then they'd vote on final passage, but nobody has any idea when that will be. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, good weather for the start of the Kobuk 440 in Kotzebue.
So we'll probably see a few tan mushers cross the finish line this year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The House Finance Committee today released their version of a bill that would overhaul the state's oil tax policy. It's forecasted to cut taxes by $3.5 billion over the next 5 years, a smaller amount than the last proposal. That number is expected to appease swing votes on the bill. Like all other drafts of the bill, the House Finance version would get rid of progressivity, a mechanism that raises taxes on oil as the price per barrel goes up. Instead, it would set a tax ceiling of 35% for all oil. When it comes to oil extracted from legacy fields, producers would get a credit that operates on a sliding scale of sorts, with that credit getting smaller as oil companies are seeing higher profits. With new oil, the state would let a fifth of that go tax-free, while offering a flat $5 per barrel credit on the rest of it. With the legislature scheduled to gavel out on Sunday, this should be one of the last major revisions of the bill. The Kobuk 440, Kotzebue's annual sled dog race, kicked off at 12:30 this afternoon. 18 mushers signed up this year, and Kobuk 440 board president Liz Moore says this number's on the high end. She says they did have to make some team changes before the race got started.
Pat Moon had to step out of the race, so Nicole Faley stepped in with his team, and then Zoya Janeiro was not able to make it up to Kotzebue. So John Schammelmeyer is running in her place, and both of them just had complications outside of the race that they needed to attend to. But luckily, we were able to keep their teams in the race, and they're both running.
How are trail conditions, and what's the weather supposed to be like over the next few days?
We have a beautiful day today. It's sunny outside. It's probably about 5 below. There's no wind. And most of the race, because we're at the end of the season and it's springtime up here, will be like that. It'll be pretty cold, but it'll be pretty sunny. So it'll be tough for the mushers on the long stretches between Kiana and Ambler and then Ambler back to Selwick, where they're going to be out in the daylight and kind of in the sun. They'll have to manage their dogs and make sure they don't get too warm. So we'll probably see a few tan mushers cross the finish line this year like we did last year. But upriver, in terms of trail conditions, we have really good trails. And then as you start to get to the interior towards Ambler, Shungnak, and Kobuk, which are our upriver communities, we're seeing trail conditions where we've had to move the trail a little bit to ensure that we avoid overflow. And we have an amazing group of people out in the villages who volunteer for this race who are making sure those trails are safe, making sure they're well-marked and that mushers are fed when they come into the communities and warm, even if they are wet from any overflow on the river.
Liz Moore is the Kobuk 440 board president. The 440-mile race starts in Kotzebue and stops at checkpoints in Norvik, Kiana, Selawik, Ambler, Shungnak, and Kobuk. The race ends back in Kotzebue, where the first mushers are expected Sunday morning. Moore says the total purse this year is $50,200. First place pays $12,000. Links to more information are at our website, alaskapublic.org. The National Park Service released its compendiums for 2013 this week. They outlined this year's designations, closures, and restrictions for national parks and preserves. Some of the changes to Alaska's compendiums this year come in response to state policies regarding predators like wolves and bears. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
The National Park Service received more than 59,000 comments last year as the agency set to work compiling changes and revisions to this year's rules and regulations regarding Park Service-managed land. John Quinley is the Park Service spokesman for the Alaska region.
There were some actions taken by the State Board of Game extending the wolf hunting and trapping season and coyote seasons. They also, in certain areas, allowed the baiting of brown bears. And both of those cases, we have taken actions to dial the season back and to stop bear baiting in national preserves.
Quinley says state policies are not in keeping with the Park Service's federal mandate. Doug Vincent Lang is the director of Alaska's Division of Wildlife Conservation with the Department of Fish and Game. He disagrees.
Remember, Congress gave them organic legislation to manage their parks, but we feel that their organic legislation should be viewed through the lens of the subsequent ANILCA legislation that created some of these additional parks and preserves in Alaska, and that as such, the default should be allowance for hunting and fishing as long as it doesn't affect the conservation of those species.
ANILCA, or the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, was passed by Congress in 1980. It designated over 100 million acres of land in the state to be managed federally by the Park Service, Forest Service, and the Fish and Wildlife Service. Vincent Lang drafted a lengthy letter in opposition to changes in the Park Service compendiums this year. He says he doesn't think the agency adequately responded to the state's comments.
They readily acknowledge that the restrictions on those hunting opportunities are not based on conservation concerns. That is, it's not affecting the sustainabilities of wolves, coyotes, or bears, but it's based on some subjective value system. And we ask for how they quantitatively or even qualitatively reach that assessment, and none of that information was provided to us.
But John Quinley says the Park Service responded as the state advised.
We have asked on numerous occasions that the Board of Game exempt national preserves from some of these wildlife provisions that we feel liberalize the hunting and trapping seasons and the methods and means too far. They have essentially told us to use our own process, which is the compendium and regulation process.
Quinley says both agencies cooperate well on joint research, but that direction from Congress and that coming from Alaska's legislature differ fundamentally. Doug Vincent Lang says the state will review the compendiums before taking any action. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
In a release today, the National Park Service states the wolf population in the Yukon-Charlie National Preserve has decreased by 50% since last fall. The Park Service says the decline coincides with predator control efforts by Alaska Department of Fish and Game conducted near the preserve. In November, Park Service biologists counted 80 wolves in 9 packs in the region. They say hunters and trappers typically take about 6 wolves near the preserve each winter. This spring, biologists took advantage of the late season snowfall to survey wolves in the preserve by air. They counted up to 39 wolves in 6 packs. The agency says it's the steepest decline on record for wolves in the Yukon-Charlie National Preserve.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
A farmhouse built in Palmer in 1935 has been added to the National Register of Historic Places. The Campbell House was one of the original Matanuska Colony farmhouses. The house is a rare example of an intact frame-built home from the colony period that still has historical and physical integrity. It joins more than 15 other colony properties already listed on the register, according to Judy Bittner, State Historical Preservation Officer. The house gets its name from George and Annabelle Campbell of Michigan, who drew Lot 54 in the lottery held for colonists to receive farm sites. A state fine particulate pollution implementation plan for the Fairbanks area due out this summer will likely include burn bans. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the yet-to-be-released plan for getting Fairbanks into compliance with federal air quality regulations was previewed this week.
In a presentation to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins said the state is not releasing details yet, but has indicated to him that limits on wood burning will likely be part of the federally required implementation plan.
So area curtailment during episodes. So when we have a bad air day, the state could be calling for a localized no burn area.
Hopkins told chamber members the state is also looking at tightening emission standards for outdoor boilers sold and installed in the Fairbanks North Pole area.
They'll say that outdoor wood boilers will have to meet a certain standard of particulates. And from what I understand of the our current measurements, some of the outdoor coal boilers will not be allowed to be sold anymore because they might not be meeting the standard.
Mayor Hopkins outlined expected emissions controls following a winter in which a federal fine particulate pollution standard was violated dozens of times locally, including on 70 days in North Pole. A large component of the smoke trapped by cold air inversions is attributed to residential wood and coal heating. But Hopkins said the state plan will also target emissions from industrial facilities.
In short, that means the tall stacks that are in our community, they're looking at right now reasonable technologies and control measures to yet reduce the some of the pollution that comes out of the stacks. So try to tighten down on industrial facilities, in other words, the coal power plants.
The implementation plan, originally due to the Environmental Protection Agency last December, is scheduled to go out for public review in July in anticipation of submission to the EPA by the end of the year. Hopkins said the state's enforceable measures will be complemented by local voluntary efforts, including an enhanced wood stove and boiler changeout program that targets pollution hotspot neighborhoods. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A bill setting up a missing persons alert system for seniors with Alzheimer's, veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, and other vulnerable adults passed the Alaska State Senate yesterday after already getting approval in the House. The legislation tasks the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs with creating a silver alert system. It would be triggered when adults with special needs go missing, much in the same way that Amber Alerts are used for children who have been abducted. The bill would make participation in the system voluntary for newspaper, radio, and television outlets. The measure was introduced by Representative Max Gruenberg, an Anchorage Democrat. It's the first bill from a member of the minority caucus that has gotten through the legislature. It passed unanimously in both chambers. Officials in Galena continue laying the groundwork to fund a community-wide woody biomass project. KIYU's Jeremy Scott has more.
An early projection of the fiscal year 2014 state capital budget shows a $317,000 appropriation for that biomass project, courtesy of the Alaska Energy Authority. School Superintendent Chris Raitan says that would help with approximately 11% of the project's total estimated cost.
We were going for the whole like $2.8 million. The dollar amount that we got was like, you know what, that's the next incremental step for this project, to do the design for the whole biomass facility. I mean, we wanted more. But just like one of the stones, you can't always get what you want, but try sometime, you might find you get what you need. We got exactly what we needed.
Raitan is part of a group of people representing the Galena City School District, City of Galena, and Loudoun Tribal Council meeting weekly to figure out a tentative timeline for getting a boiler system up and running to heat the campus of the Galena Interior Learning Academy. That group has been working under the title of Sustainable Energy for Galena, Alaska, or SEGA, and hopes to incorporate soon into an official nonprofit consortium. While incorporating a nonprofit consortium takes many steps, Loudoun Tribal Council Administrator March Runner says it's just one stretch of what has so far been a three-year road to getting biomass to Galena.
That's not done overnight. It takes a lot of planning, a lot of work. We started out with the reconnaissance air survey, then we had the feasibility study. Now we have the forest inventory. We're working on a business plan now, the corporation papers. And in the harvest, we're also looking at the harvest to be the least impact on the land and the environment, and also to help with the moose population and the subsistence lifestyle, so it doesn't disrupt the subsistence lifestyle at all.
The original plans for the project had to be scrapped after a feasibility study revealed Galena does not have the infrastructure for a combined heat and power, or CHP, system, and can currently only support a heating system. Officials had hoped to cut down the trees this past winter to have the biomass system in place by early 2014, but the project got delayed. When the Air Force officially left Galena in 2008, it estimated it left behind enough fuel to heat the Interior Learning Academy until 2017. As he awaits final word from Juneau about whether or not the $317,000 sticks in the upcoming fiscal year's budget, City Manager Greg Moyer says he and his biomass partners will continue meeting, eyes firmly fixed on making sure when 2017 arrives, Galena is prepared.
It's all going to come together, and we're positive it will. If it doesn't, it will go back to other ideas, and that's the important thing of maybe starting a consortium, that we as a community are going to keep talking about these things. So I'm optimistic. I always am. So we'll have to see, but we're going to move ahead because we have to do something. And in all areas, maybe biomass, solar, or whatever, to find that renewable resource.
Early studies have shown a woody biomass project would reduce diesel fuel consumption in Galena by roughly 230,000 gallons a year. Reporting from Galena, I'm Jeremy Scott.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Jeremy Scott in Galena. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Register now for the 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena Center in Anchorage. This fifth annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts and learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Online registration ends on April 26th. More information at www.bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.